Maureen Cullen Taylor, welcome to Experience Talks, where we hear from people over 30 you can trust. Today, stories of egomania and madness. As Aristotle told us, no great genius has ever existed without some touch of madness. On today's programme, author T.C. Boyle talks about his newest novel about the famously egomaniacal architect Frank Lloyd Wright. Psychiatrist and author Dr. Ira Steinman talks about treating the untreatable. And Cynthia Friedloeb gives us her take on the utter madness of labeling people. All this today on Experience Talks. First up, writer T.C. Boyle. T.C. Boyle is the acclaimed author of 12 novels, including the Penn Faulkner Award-winning World's End and Drop City, a finalist for the National Book Award. His newest novel, The Women, focuses on architect Frank Lloyd Wright through the lens of his messy relationships with his wives and mistresses. Tim Carpenter talks now with T.C. Boyle from his home, the George C. Stewart House, Frank Lloyd Wright's first California design.
T.C. Boyle, welcome to Experience Talks.
Yes, hello, Tim.
So, Tom, can you start off by reading a passage from the book?
Sure, I'd be happy to. Why don't I just read from the very beginning of the book to give you a quick introduction. Now, Tim, you wanted me to read all 462 pages?
Very slowly, if you could.
Or just a paragraph, perhaps.
That sounds great.
Paragraph. How's that?
Sounds great.
This novel is narrated by an invented character named Tadashi Sato, who was an apprentice of Frank Lloyd Wright's in 1932. And this is how he began as he goes on his way in rural Wisconsin to meet the master. I didn't know much about automobiles at the time, still don't for that matter. But it was an automobile that took me to Taliesin in the fall of 1932, through a country alternately fortified with trees and rolled out like a carpet to the back wall of its barns, hayricks, and farmhouses, through towns with names like Black Earth, Mazamani, and Coon Rock, where no one in living memory had ever seen a Japanese face, or a Chinese either. Stop for fuel, a sandwich, a chance to use the washroom, and you'd think a man had come down from Mars and propped himself up on the seat of a perfectly ordinary canary yellow and pit of hell black Stutz Bearcat Roadster. And what is a Bearcat, anyway? Some hybrid monster out of an ad man's inventory, I suppose, a thing to roar and paw and dig at the roadway. And so this one did, as advertised. Mostly, along that route on a day too hot for October, and too still, too clear, as if the season would never change. People just stared till they caught themselves and looked away as if what they'd seen hadn't registered, not even as a fleeting image on the retina. But one man, and I won't take him to task here because he didn't know any better, and I was used to it by then, responded to my request for a hamburger sandwich by dropping his jaw a foot and a half and exclaiming, "Well, Jesus H. Christ, you're a Chinaman, ain't you?"
It's a bang-up start.
Yeah, that's how Tadashi gets his inoculation of Midwest prejudice in the year 1932.
So first off, what inspired you to write this book?
Well, as you may know, Tim, I have written about such figures in the past. My fiction is very various. This is my 20th book, and I've written historical novels that have invented characters. I've written contemporary novels, short stories, and I've also written a series of novels that contain what I like to call the great egomaniacs of 20th century America. So I wrote The Road to Wellville in 1993 about John Harvey Kellogg, inventor of the cornflake. Then in 2004, The Inner Circle about Alfred C. Kinsey, who, of course, invented sex. And now we have Frank Lloyd Wright. And I had been wanting to write about Frank Lloyd Wright for a long while because he fits into this group of people who are extremely narcissistic, powerful personalities who view the entire world as viable only as it fits into their enterprise. At any rate, the introduction pointed out, and my wife and I were fortunate enough to find a house for sale by Frank Lloyd Wright 16 years ago, and we've been restoring it ever since. And during that time, I'd been brooding on the master who created this wonderful space and eager to know more about him all during that period.
So you chose to tell Frank Lloyd Wright's story through the lens of his relationships with his women. Why? Why did you choose that path?
Well, again, this man, Frank Lloyd Wright, is a cult figure, far more than I had ever imagined when I first started to go and do research for this. But I can assure you that people are lined up in the freezing cold in Oak Park, Illinois right now, speaking every language in the world, waiting to go in and see his first house and studio there. It's quite extraordinary. There have been over 1,000 books written about him and his work. So, of course, I'm always looking for a new approach. And he does appear in the book, as you know, briefly. We do get his point of view occasionally. But primarily, this is written from the point of view of the four women in his life, his three wives and his mistress, Mamie Borthwick Cheney. The reason for that is that we can see this legendary American figure from people with a kind of jaundiced eye to get a better sense of what it might have been like to know him.
So when you researched the book, how did you go about that? You mentioned that there's a lot of writing about this man. How did you go about finding out how you wanted to tell your story?
Well, first, of course, as I do with any novel, I plunged into the available texts. And there are many memoirs and biographies of Frank Lloyd Wright, the nine best of which, I think, are listed in my acknowledgments. I plowed through these things, read his own autobiography, of course, everything I could find about him. Then I went off in search of the place itself. So the book is primarily set at Taliesin. So I went and visited Taliesin as a tourist and had a walkthrough. As I mentioned earlier, I did go to Oak Park, Illinois, too, where he built many of his great early houses and where he had his own house, where he lived with his wife, Kitty, his first wife, and his six children, prior to running off to Europe in 1909 with the wife of one of his clients, Mamie Borthwick Cheney.
And in researching the book, what was the most interesting thing that you found out about him?
I found out that he is my polar opposite in one way. We do have some things in common, of course. We both make our little architectural projects. He built houses, I build novels. It's the same sort of thing. We're both artists. We're both completely obsessed with our work. But he, in order to work, needed to have absolute tumult in his life. He needed to be harassed by the press, headlines about him living in sin with one mistress or another. He never paid any debts. He constantly had debt collectors and lawyers and the sheriff after him. He was just hounded constantly. He seemed to thrive in that atmosphere. He seemed to love the idea that he was against the world. His family motto is truth against the world. My family motto, by the way, is we are always in a hurry. And I need complete placidity, quiet, no worries whatsoever in order to get into this dream that I have to get into each day to discover what I'm writing about. So that to me was pretty extraordinary.
You live in a Wright house. How did that affect the way you wrote this story? I can't imagine that it must have been a little strange sitting in one of his houses as you were writing his story.
Absolutely. My initial impulse was to learn more about him and to create a fiction around him, as I've done with these other figures. It is special. It's special to be here right now looking out the windows into greenery. You know, it's a prairie-style house, and so his genius was to present us with open spaces and open walls so that there's no place to hang a painting. The outdoors is the painting, and I'm looking out right now. I can see the Santa Ynez Mountains and the oak trees, and it's all very nice. On the other hand, I'd written 12 other books in this house in the interval, so it was business as usual. However, I did develop a much greater appreciation for his work, and I became something of an expert, at least so that I could speak with some authority about the house I'm living in and our restoration of it. And that was quite good and quite touching. Probably the closest I came to him, though, was the second visit to Taliesin after the book was done, and this would have been in the fall of 07. The very kind people at the foundation insisted that my wife and I should spend the night at Taliesin alone, in the very bed. And that was pretty damned exciting, boy, because, first of all, we were freezing to death all night long. And secondly, the ghosts were howling and pounding at the walls so that I could barely sleep.
So one of the things that's interesting about that house is I read somewhere that Wright had designed the house around the idea of family and being able to see each other and experience the family. It's a bit ironic in retrospect, I guess, given that you told us that he left.
Yeah, it is strange. I love his ideas. I really do. He's a genius. His art is alive today. It's influenced us in many ways we don't even think about. For instance, you know, the ranch houses that a lot of us grew up in the 50s and 60s were an outgrowth of some of his design ideas, and, for instance, his Usonian houses. And yet, he was a man of contradictions, as we all are, I suppose. This house I'm living in was built in 1909, and as you say, the prairie style was always built around a central hearth. The interior walls are removed so that there are glass panels so you can see from one end of the house to the other, and this presumably was so the family could be together. And, of course, and this will come as a shock to some of your listeners, but I think, judging from your demographic, not so many, this is pre-video game, so that families had to gather around and read poetry, sing songs, be together in a way that that perhaps we're not anymore because we're all locked away with our machines and our TVs. And yes, there is an essential irony here. The very year he built this house was the year that he fled with Mema and left his wife, Kitty, and their six children behind with a huge mountain of debt, including a $900 grocery bill. And this is in 1909. Can you imagine what that translates to in today's dollars?
Amazing.
I'm guessing about $3 billion. What do you think?
Maybe less this year.
Yeah.
Of the four women in the novel, who was the most challenging character for you to write, and which was the most fun for you?
Great question. Kitty, the first wife, doesn't play a great role in the book because the book begins during his lost years when he does run off with Mema. And then we go on from there to the end of his career. But the book has an interesting structure. Tadashi is telling it, but he's telling it as a memoir through the point of view of these women. And it goes in reverse order so that we meet his last wife, Olgivana, first, and see his second wife, Miriam, as this harpy harassing them, and on to the end. So we do get Kitty at the end when she is influenced by and horrified by the fact that her husband has run off with Mema. And incidentally, Kitty, when it was discovered that Frank Lloyd Wright was in Europe, registered as Frank Lloyd Wright and wife, the newspapers, the Chicago Tribune came up with this, it was presented to her as fact, and she gave a press conference with her minister and said that she loved him, that he would come back to her, she stood by him, and that really all this was that he was under the influence of a vampire, that is, Mema.
Amazing.
All good stuff, yeah. So she was the toughest to inhabit because she doesn't play as big a role. Again, this book could have been 10,000 pages long. An artist has to decide what material to include and what not. So she was the most difficult because she was pure and noble and sweet and loved her man and stood by him. And who wants to read about things like that when you can read about someone like Miriam, his second wife, who was just this terror from hell. She was just this marvelous, larger-than-life character. I had so much fun with her. She was 45 when she met Frank Lloyd Wright, and in these circumstances, Mema, as I think probably everybody listening will know, was murdered at Taliesin. After Frank brought her back from Europe, he established her in Taliesin in Wisconsin, where his mother's family had come from, built the great house, Taliesin, there. While he was in Chicago working on the Midway Gardens, she, her two children, and four others were murdered by a disaffected servant. The place was burned to the ground. This was reported in the press throughout the world. Meanwhile, Miriam had left Paris, where she'd been living as a widow for 10 years at the outset of World War I. And she had read about Frank Lloyd Wright and wrote him a sympathy letter. And it was such a passionate letter that he agreed to meet with her at his offices in Chicago. And he tells about this in his autobiography just wonderfully. She was very flamboyant, very beautiful, massive red-gold curls, and, you know, the style of the day in 1914 with the beads. She was wearing a sealskin cape, this marvelous big hat, a lorgnette, a cigarette in a holder, the whole thing. And she stormed in on him and talked about romance and poetry. And then she finally took a breath and said, "So what do you think of me?" And he said, "I've never seen anything like you." Boom, it went from there. Within 6 months after the death of Mema, he established Miriam as his mistress at Taliesin. And 10 years later, he married her. She left him. And he was already involved with his last wife, Olgivana.
Do you think that the tragic death of Mema had an effect on Wright and his relationships from that point on? Was she the one for him in that tragedy? Had a deeper effect, do you think?
Well, there's been a lot of speculation, of course, but no one could really know. People ask me also on this book tour, you know, was he a womanizer? I don't think so. I think he was a man who got attached to women, as the evidence shows, for long periods of time. And he was attracted to the strong-willed, highly educated, sophisticated women. And Mema certainly represented this. Kitty was uneducated, beyond high school. Mema was college-educated. She spoke fluent German. She was an early feminist, a devotee of Ellen Key, her translator of Ellen Key, the early feminist from Sweden. All of this was quite exotic, and he gave up everything for her, and it was all destroyed before his eyes. It's hard to say. My guess, knowing his modus operandi, is that perhaps he would have stayed with her for a long while. But I'll bet someone else would have come along. It just seemed that that was his pattern.
Sure.
And by the way, that's where we also differ. I'm the only writer in American history only to have one wife.
And lucky she is.
Oh, and lucky I am. You talk about genius here. There's a tagline inside the cover of the book, "Is it easy to live with a genius?" And, you know, you just have to ask my wife, who treats me as if I'm a household servant.